This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. A battle is taking place in the small Persian Gulf island nation of Bahrain. There's a Sunni government there that's been cracking down on its Shiite majority population and bringing down the criticism of the United Nations and the United States for doing so. But it's important to understand what's at stake here. Bahrain is where the U.S. stations its Fifth Fleet in order to patrol the Persian Gulf, and it's definitely a hotly contested piece of real estate with a lot at stake for both Saudi Arabia and Iran. What happens here really could have broader implications for the region. Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal is going to help us to understand why. New Zealand is in a tight spot right now. Its economy is in tough shape, but it looks like it doesn't really control its own destiny. It appears that its critical dairy industry and its land are being systematically bought up by Chinese businesses. This is a trend we see playing out in other nations as well, but we're going to look at how this actually fulfills some very specific biblical prophecies. In our third segment, we're going to talk about getting older. Science is showing more and more just how much control we have over our quality of life as we age. We're going to talk with nutritionist and personal trainer Jörg Mardian about some practical steps you can take to help ensure that your later years are more robust and healthy. And I'll conclude today's show by talking about the importance of every small step you take. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. This past year has been a big one for Iran. The nuclear deal was agreed to 1 year ago this week. Somehow, Iran has shed its rogue status. It's doing business with nations all over the world, so its ambitions to become king of the Middle East are gaining new momentum with the help of the United States and other Western nations. And one area where you see an alignment between Iran and the U.S. and also the United Nations concerns the nation of Bahrain. This is a tiny island nation right off the coast of Saudi Arabia in the Persian Gulf. It's one of only a few countries in the world outside Iran with a Shiite majority. Iran wants control of Bahrain, and it seems that the U.S. and the U.N. are willing to give it an assist in attaining this goal. And to tell us about this, why it's worth keeping our eyes on, we have Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal via Skype from our office in Jerusalem. Hello, Brent.
Hello.
So let's talk first of all about what's happening in Bahrain right now that makes this a story.
Right. There has been a number of reports over the past couple of months that have come out talking about exactly how the government of Bahrain, that is Sunni, how they are cracking down pretty hard on civil liberties of their population, which is mostly Shiite, because they say they're scared of, they're worried about the level of incitement that a lot of the Shiite religious leaders and Shiite protesters are bringing up to try and delegitimize the government, to try and get a revolution of sorts started, to try and overwhelm the Sunni-led government. So you've got a number of big moves that the government has done, and the biggest thing that's got everybody up in arms, it seems, is the revoking of a lot of citizenship or part of their citizenry. Those Shiite leaders inside Iran that are fomenting revolution, at least according to the government of Bahrain, they have revoked their citizenship and booted them from the country. The most important one of these was Sheikh Isa Qassim. He was the highest religious figure in Bahrain. And last month, the government revoked his citizenship and booting him from the country. And this has got the majority of their population up in arms because they're losing their spiritual leader. And they also banned the country's chief opposition party as well. They boasted the largest number of the seats inside the government, and they disbanded that opposition, which the international community is kind of up in arms at this because it looks like they're destroying any the remnants of the democratic state that existed in Bahrain. So those are the kind of things that the Bahraini government has been done because they say they feel threatened by those Shiite leaders in their country.
So let's talk about what makes Bahrain so strategically important. It's right there next to Saudi Arabia. Maybe you can just tell us about the competing interests that Saudi Arabia and Iran have about this this strategic territory.
Yeah, it's very easy to forget about a nation as small as Bahrain. It's got a little over a million people. But because of its location, geographically, it is extremely important. And it has throughout history been a territory that has gone backwards and forwards or back and forth between Persian dominance and dominance from the Gulf. It's a critical area, the Persian Gulf. Most people know because of the amount of oil that travels through the Persian Gulf and out into the market. I think it's about 30% of seaborne trade, something like that. And Bahrain is located on the very western side of the upper Persian Gulf. It's quite a distance away from Iran on one side of the Persian Gulf, and it's only 16 miles away from Saudi Arabia on one side, on the other side of the Persian Gulf.
So Saudi Arabia definitely has the geographic advantage, but the population of Bahrain is more closely aligned, religiously at least, with Iran.
Yeah, exactly. And not just Bahrain is religiously aligned with Iran, but the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, which is just 16 miles away from Bahrain, that's the eastern province, they are mostly Shiites as well. While Saudi Arabia is a Sunni state, I think it's up about 85% of the population. It follows the Sunni version of Islam. The majority of the eastern province, which is closest to Bahrain, follows Shia, the Shia version of Islam. So Saudi Arabia is worried that if there is a Shiite takeover in Bahrain, right next door, its eastern province, they would be able to motivate or even inspire this eastern province of Saudi Arabia to try and rebel against the monarchy there. Now, why is that important? That's important because most of Saudi Arabia's most important oil fields, of which it derives its most, by far the majority of the government spending, comes from oil, that is located too in this eastern province as well. So they cannot at all costs lose the eastern province of Saudi Arabia because then they're going to lose a lot of their control over their finances.
How fair is it to assume that the Shia in, eastern Saudi Arabia and the Shia of Bahrain would be aligned politically and maybe with respect to geopolitical goals with those of Iran?
Now, that's a very good question, and we shouldn't broad brush this by just saying that just because somebody's a Shiite that they want to live under Iran's rule. Now, Azerbaijan, that's a Shiite majority country just north of Iran, and yet they are closer to Israel than they are to Iran. So just because somebody's a Shiite does not mean definitely that they are aligned with the mother country's goals. Although in the case of Bahrain and eastern Saudi Arabia, just from the preaching of a lot of their own religious Shiite figures, they do talk about Khomeini quite a lot. They are his. They do follow him. He is considered their spiritual leader there. So there would be a portion of the Shiite population in Bahrain that does not want Iranian influence. They would say as much. And yet, Iran is able to motivate the most vocal of the Shiites there to try and promote unrest. And we've seen them do this before. We've seen them do this in 1981. They sponsored a terrorist group to try and lead a revolution. It wasn't successful. And then back in 2011, when the Arab Spring was tearing up the Middle East, when dictators were falling because of populations that did not like them, Iran again was trying to stir up the Bahraini populace. And they were almost very successful at doing that. The only reason that the Bahraini government didn't fall is because that Saudi Arabia, they sent in 1,000 of their soldiers across the bridge that goes all the way to Saudi Arabia to Bahrain to forcefully put down this rebellion. So there has been proof in the past that our Iran can foment a revolution here, and you know has tried to do that.
And Iran's definitely looking at it in terms of establishing an Iranian-aligned Shiite government within Bahrain. And Saudi Arabia certainly seems to be viewing it as that is the threat that they're facing. And you're saying essentially, or maybe entirely, it's the Saudi oil fields that would be at stake here. Are there other factors that would be at play that would really make this a blow or that would really advance Iranian interests if that were to happen?
Well, the other thing to think about, because just the Saudi oil fields are a huge, you can't like belittle that, or because it is the way that Saudi Arabia functions, is that they get their oil to market. But the other thing that you have is that located on the island of Bahrain is the United States Fifth Fleet. It's been there since 1991. And it has been a huge stabilizing influence through the Persian Gulf to have the U.S. Fifth Fleet there. It's 15,000 men or sailors on boats, 1,000 sailors on the shores, on land in Bahrain. And the question is, would an Iranian takeover of Bahrain, would the United States stay there after that? Now, it's interesting because right now we're seeing the United States and Iran becoming far closer, upsetting the global, well, the Middle Eastern order that's been in place for the past 30 years. So maybe they would allow the United States to be there. But I don't think so. I think if Iran does take over Bahrain, the United States is going to be happy to leave at that point. Even if it's not this administration that is seen in friendly terms with Iran, we know that one of the Republican candidate for presidency has said that Saudi Arabia can basically look after itself. Why are we funding Saudi Arabia's military? Well, Saudi Arabia's military needs to protect Bahrain from Iran. So he's even said that, what are we doing there in the Persian Gulf? Iran has always wanted all outside influences, external influences outside the Persian Gulf. They wanted the United States to leave. So if they do get in power there, I can see that being the next step. And then you have a scary thought. You have Iran policing the Persian Gulf completely, which is terrifying to a lot of people, and particularly those in Europe, I would imagine.
Well, in some ways, it seems like you're almost talking about an inevitability with the disappearance of the American presence from that region. Who's there to stop it?
And that's why we're seeing this Bahraini crackdown right now. They know, on the Shiites in their country, they know that this was going to make them lose friends internationally. Yet they are trying to get rid of any rebel rouser, anyone that from their country that has the opportunity to lead an insurrection. They want them out, and they want them fast, because they know they're losing the support of the United States and they can't afford a revolution. So they're trying to get rid of those Shiites as fast as possible.
You've alluded to it slightly, but maybe you could just help to put this into the context of biblical prophecy and how we might expect this to play out.
Yeah, it's interesting because Bahrain sits inside the Persian Gulf, and the typical alliance that we know about in biblical prophecy, or alliances as far as the Middle East goes, is the group that's aligned with Iran, and the Sunni-led Saudi Arabia, Persian Gulf, Turkey, Psalm 83 alliance. And Bahrain, while they're not Persian, they have historically been part of the Persian Empire. So I don't know where Bahrain is necessarily going to fall. I don't know if Bible prophecy is that clear about that. But Bible prophecy is very clear that the king of the south, a radical Islam headed by Iran, is going to have an extremely pushy foreign policy. At least according to Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40, it says that it pushes at the king of the north. Now, how could Iran do that? How could they push at Europe? In what way would they have them over a barrel? If I could say that, one could be Islamic terrorism. They could keep trying to increase terrorist acts in mainland Europe. That could get a response. But the way to get a response fast is to cut off Europe's oil. And you are really hamstringing, but they're really making it difficult for Europe to act when our 21st century economies run on oil, and Europe gets the majority or a lot of its oil from the Persian Gulf. And Iran could, it looks like, put a stop to that if it controls the Persian Gulf.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about the battle over Bahrain. He's working on an article on this subject, and you can look for that on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate that, Brent. You really did well at helping us to understand the significance of this situation.
Yeah, it's an important one, and I'm over here, so it's easier to focus on it. But I think people should watch Bahrain, see how Iran is going to try and take over there.
Very good. Thanks very much.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
New Zealand is a rather small country out in the Pacific Ocean east of Australia, but it is the largest dairy exporter on the planet. And there's a reason for that. Their dairy products are amazing. I have been there and tasted of the goodness of New Zealand dairy. They export 95% of what they produce. And this industry really is the backbone of New Zealand's economy. But something is happening to jeopardize that, and that is China. Chinese businesses have been taking over New Zealand farms and really threatening to undermine New Zealand's economy. And it also, this trend gives us a glimpse into just how China operates. I have a native Kiwi here to talk about this, Chris Eames. Right now, he's a transplant living in the United Kingdom. We have him here via Skype. This is first time on Trumpet Hour. Hello, Chris.
Greetings.
So China loves its New Zealand dairy products. Maybe you could just give us a sense of the trade relationship and the economics of what's happening here to begin with.
Okay, sure. Well, over the last few years or so, what New Zealanders have noticed is a huge boom in the dairy industry heading towards China. A lot of product, especially powdered milk, is being bought up in China en masse. So New Zealand thought, hey, this is great. We've got a big ballooning industry here. We'll prepare for it, get set up for a big boost in trade here with China. That's just going to continue and continue. Well, the problem here with the New Zealand farmers and those who are preparing for this boom is that suddenly China pulls out after a few years, and it becomes clear that China's actually been stockpiling these products that they're buying from New Zealand and decides they essentially don't want any more. So we've got China in terms of powdered milk, one of the favorites for China. They've been stockpiling around 300,000 tons of the stuff. And so New Zealand here is all set, ready to go to be producing all this extra dairy product. And suddenly there's not as much market left for it. And so that's causing a big economic downturn in New Zealand, which is a big problem because the dairy farms make up about 25% of New Zealand's economy. And so what's happening now is New Zealand is running up massive debt and economic trouble with the farms to the tune of an average of 10,000 New Zealand dollars of debt per cow, which is an incredible amount of debt here. And you look at the average New Zealand farm runs about 400 dairy cows. So you multiply that $10,000 per cow by the 400 average New Zealand cows on each farm, and that's causing major problems for these farmers, even causing fear of suicide for some of them. The dairy farmer rate of suicide is higher than the urban population in New Zealand, the pressure of running at that kind of a debt. And you have these farmers now starting to want to sell off these farms to get rid of this problem. And now that's causing another problem because now we see China.
Now, hold on just a second here, Chris. Help me to make this leap from selling powdered milk and thinking that they had a market, an ongoing market for powdered milk, and suddenly they're running a catastrophic debt of $10,000 a cow. How much does a cow cost?
Well, a cow, if you're looking for a dairy cow now in New Zealand, you'll get one for around 1,000 New Zealand dollars. Now, I think that's about 800 US dollars. So about 1,000 New Zealand dollars, probably more depending on where you're living, but say around $1,000. So statistically, that cow, once you've bought it, immediately becomes 9,000 New Zealand dollars, less than nothing, essentially. So that's just crazy figures
okay.
for New Zealand farmers.
So now, but what all contributed to the debt? Surely there must have been a confluence of factors here besides just the assumption that there would be an ongoing powdered milk market or Chinese dairy product market.
You've just got so much being produced by these farms now, as far as I know, and the demand is just going down for that. And New Zealanders need about $5.25 per product to break even. At the moment, it's averaging for the farmer about $4.30. And so that's way below what they can even break even with. So there's just an overabundance of product here for China, for other countries, for New Zealand itself. And New Zealand essentially doesn't know what to do with it in order to bring that price back up.
And what China did, it seems like this is almost maybe that there was some design behind this. If they bought a tremendous amount of this product, they stockpiled it, and then they basically shut the consumption off, that this exacerbated an already problematic situation where you had below market prices. The farmers were already going under. This made it many times worse.
Exactly. You can see some possible planning behind it. It happened to Australia. New Zealand should have been the wiser. It happened to Australia with iron ore stockpiling in 2013, Chinese buying en masse iron ore, stockpiling it, and then cutting what they wanted. Then they moved over to the powdered milk from New Zealand. And essentially what it's done is it sucked up all the powdered milk that they want, then cut what then they've cut their consumption of it, or rather their stockpiling of it. And so that's left New Zealand farms high and dry. And now that devalues the land in order for Chinese investors, however connected they are to the Chinese government itself, but nonetheless Chinese billionaires, Chinese investors, in order to buy up that land for themselves at a cheaper price, at a reduced rate, and then be essentially making that product for themselves for the future ahead.
And so this is where we're ultimately ending up, is we're talking about massive transfer of ownership of New Zealand land into Chinese proprietorship.
Exactly. And it's gotten New Zealanders worried. A few years ago, it started getting several New Zealanders worried. That level is increasing more and more as more farms are being bought up. Now, New Zealand has more foreign investment from countries like the US, even countries like Israel. China's about number 5 on the ratio at the moment. But if we just look in the last few years, we see the rate China has been increasing its amount of purchases in New Zealand, and that is skyrocketing more than any other country. We're seeing a bigger balloon by China. And obviously that has cause for New Zealand to be having some concern over that.
And China is buying up land all over the place. That's happening within the United States. It's happening in African nations. So this is part of something that they're really implementing on a global scale.
That's right. China is essentially building her empire through that. And you ask, why should she not? She's got a ballooning population. They've just cut the one-child policy down. at the moment, and they need the product, they need the land for their increasing population. And so we should be wary when we see these things developing in New Zealand and all over the world. In Australia, they just sold their largest dairy to China. New Zealand has sold 29 farms at the moment to China, and it makes sense for them to be buying up so much land in order to keep their big population running.
Now, you're working on an article about this for thetrumpet.com, and in that article, you draw attention to several biblical prophecies that you could really look at what is happening to New Zealand as fulfilling. Maybe you could just talk us through those a bit.
Okay, sure. Well, the importance of attaching New Zealand and these English-speaking peoples to these prophecies is understanding what these people are labeled as in these prophecies. And now the book of Hosea in the Bible actually talks a lot about our peoples today, our English-speaking peoples in particular, and what prophetically will be happening to them. And it states that countries like New Zealand, Australia, the Commonwealth countries, will essentially be producing product, but then it being consumed and eaten and devoured by our enemy countries, and that even those countries will rise up within our gates and then consume our product themselves. They'll lend to us, it specifically says in the book of Leviticus as well, speaking to our country, and we won't lend to them. They'll be in a position higher than us, and we won't be able to help ourselves from them, essentially. And so the Bible quite clearly states that these countries such as China will be in a power position, and New Zealand, because of her sins, because of how she's been handling herself, New Zealand and these Commonwealth countries have basically been reaping the benefits of dealing with their enemies in such a fashion.
So what would be some of the ramifications of the policies that New Zealand has undertaken here in allowing this to happen? I wonder how much of the blame do we put on New Zealand itself for permitting this to take place? I mean, you're talking about it in terms of a curse that might be, you know, it's bigger than just, well, one bad policy, but surely there were some mistakes made through this process that kind of put them into this situation.
Yeah, exactly. And we just see that New Zealand has been losing power since World War II, and a lot of mistakes being made in terms of being more friendly with countries we should be more wary of, in terms of allowing our military and our ability to react to threats to go downhill as well, in terms of the amount of Air Force and Navy that we've got. We've allowed that to diminish to a near nothing state. And so that hinges along with our policies as well that have been very open to other countries we should be more wary of. And New Zealand essentially has been a very liberal country.
Well, we appreciate you bringing this to our attention. We've been talking with Chris Eames. He's finishing up an article about this for thetrumpet.com, and it should appear on that website soon. You can go check it out. We appreciate your time, Chris.
Thank you very much. Been a pleasure.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
How can you age well? A lot of people want to live longer, and the good news is life expectancies are rising. They've risen over 50% in the last 100 years. But what is the quality of life with these longer lifespans? There's a justifiable fear of incapacity and mental decline, physical decline, really living out your final years in misery. I have nutritionist and personal trainer Jörg Mardian here via Skype from his office in British Columbia. Hello, Jörg.
Hello there.
Let's start by just talking about some of the reasons why lifespans are increasing. And maybe there are some good factors and some others that might not be so good.
And really, we've got the statistics to prove that the average life expectancy has increased by more than 50% since 1900. And I think we're peaking somewhere around 78 years right now, which is very good. That's a good life. Now, as to why, there have been advances in on several fronts. I mean, cleanliness, of course, lifestyle. They do cite medicines, interventions for diseases, and as well as natural health methods. People are just going back to eating better and trying to make sure that their body, you know, does what it's supposed to. And so, yes, we are living longer. I mean, every decade they say we've been adding 10 years. So now we come to the point where we're just about at 80 years old. And but here's the thing about this. And we get one side of the story. We're living longer, and there's this wonderful thing that medicine is doing all these wonderful things for us. But what we're not seeing over the past 50 years is that healthcare hasn't really slowed down the aging process as much as it prolongs the dying process.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's what people aren't looking at. We're prolonging the suffering. So the scientific and medical field is very adept at helping us get over the hump of a disease so we can get a stroke and they can intervene really quickly. But what happens afterwards? We're just not the same person. So they're not able to prevent ongoing disability.
What's some of the reasons why? And obviously, people want to live longer. They want to live longer to have a higher quality of life. They want to live a high quality of life in those final years. And there are a lot of examples. And you see the nursing homes filling up and retirement homes where the quality of life is really poor. How do we get to the good quality in our final years of life?
Well, there's a method that's it's approved by all health experts, and it's free. You know, we really don't have to turn to medicine or to drugs or to some therapy in a desperate way to regain good health. What we really do need to do is to stop being inactive and to start moving. So the reason I say that is we live in a lifestyle today where everything's in front of machines. We do it by machines or in front of a computer, or so we're not really moving, we're sitting. And that really carries over into senior age. And then you retire and you sit even more. So being inactive accelerates the osteopenia, which is the bone loss. And then as well as sarcopenia, which is the decline of muscle mass and function. And that's really an epidemic. It's a what we call a disuse syndrome, a process of unnecessary and rapid deterioration.
So what would you say? Is it basically use and disuse is the main factor that separates the person who ages well and retains more of the quality of life from the person who is really incapacitated?
It does. It really does. There's a new study out from the Tel Aviv University in Israel, and they found that exercise increases the amount of muscle stem cells. And that's what's in the news today, stem cell therapy for the aging process. I mean, science is really excited about this. But, you know, we can do this ourselves. And so these decline with age and with inactivity, of course, as well as the ability to revitalize the muscle. So if we're not moving, if we don't use it, we lose it. Mm-hmm. That's where the saying comes in. But they found out that just 13 weeks of endurance exercises showed a 20 to 30% increase in the stem cells retained. And in older people, it's even better. It's up to 47% stem cell increase with exercise. Now that's an amazing condition, and to be able to get moving and to maybe motivate people and say, look at you have the ability, you're not too old and you have to take it easy. You can actually go out there and you can rejuvenate your muscles. So the two types of conditions or the two types of exercises that they recommend, one is aerobic exercise, of course, and that's what this study was predicated on. So you could do running or cycling or swimming or dance, even walking it's better to be a little vigorous, but if you can't, anything helps for muscle repair. Any movement, they say, just get up off your chair, start walking. Mm-hmm. Stop the deterioration process, and it's a remarkable halting of the deterioration process. And the other is resistance exercises. Now, that's really the big one. Resistance exercises stops the bone mineral loss. And, you know, we have this epidemic of people breaking bones. Now, load-bearing exercise can a lot of times halt that process and even reverse bone loss up to the eighth decade of life.
So in your 70s?
Yeah, 70s and 80s. I mean, really, in essence, resistance training is anything that you can do with, I teach functional strength. Functional means we don't use machines where I work, but you can also use machines. But you can use dumbbells, medicine balls, kettlebells, anything that provides a resistance and that negates the experience of disease and illness and the fractures that are often associated with the aging process.
So we'll get back to the exercise in a little bit, because it'd be nice to get some specific ideas about what kinds of things that people could do, how much, and so on. But let's just talk about, you were talking about bone loss that tends to be associated with aging. What are some of the other things that happen as we age that would be associated with a high quality of life versus a low quality of life? And how much can exercise and, say, what we're doing make an impact on those factors?
Well, the low quality of life we can see today and before us. I mean, we can visit old age homes. We can see people incapacitated, needing help, needing caretakers. You have every illness and disease in a book. I mean, the disease statistics are climbing, and it's alarming. And it really, a lot of that is unnecessary. It really is when you see how little people can move. Now, when we have somebody come in here, I'll give you an example of the high quality of life. And we see it in real life situations. I had a gentleman come in here, and he started when he was 94. Just a sweet man. And he said, look, I've got two canes. What can you do? And I said, well, it depends on you. It depends on your attitude and how much you want to do. Well, here we are, just a couple years later, and he's thrown those canes away.
Wow.
I mean, he's not doing jumping jacks, but he's moving.
Yeah.
He's driving. He's walking without the canes. And he said, look, thank you so much for giving me my life. And I said, look, I didn't give you anything. I said, you made it happen. I just showed you what you needed to do. But your body came back because you put in the effort, and you were told otherwise. You were told you were fragile. And you're not fragile per se. You can actually remain very strong, very independent of others. And I just don't like to hear that people should take it easy when they retire, because taking it easy has a risk of every disease out there. And another low point that we can get to with inactivity is, of course, the mind. It's not just the muscles, but if your mind doesn't work, nothing else about is of a good quality. So even before you get the gray hair and wrinkles, you start to lose neurons, even before you see the signs of aging. So by the age 40, we lose about 10,000 neurons per day. But a lot of that blame has to go to lifestyle factors, medical drugs, hyper-processed foods, tobacco, alcohol, excess, and chemical exposure. It's not per se just the aging process. It's just gotten a bad rap, because we can age very gracefully and very strongly. And then the situation becomes very grave when we confront dementia, which is now the sixth leading cause of death in America. So But again, that this it's not all bad, because we can actually increase the growth of new neurons and brain cell as we age, as we exercise, as we move.
All right. Well, let's get into some specific prescriptions. You're telling a 94-year-old, well, you're not frail. I imagine that there are some older listeners who would say, well, yeah, that's easy for you to say. There's a lot that I can't do that I was once able to do. Is the solution you've got to get a personal trainer, or what kind of steps might someone be able to take even in their own home?
Right. Well, we live in an age of education. A personal trainer, if you can afford it, well, he can help you, of course. And in a lot of cases, that might be something that works out. If it doesn't, say for monetary reasons, then, you know, we can go to Walmart or Canadian Tire and buy a set of small dumbbells, and we can do a home exercise program of resistance training. A lot of that is available on YouTube about how to do a resistance training program for seniors. It really is that easy. Type it into YouTube, you get a video, and there's so many wonderful videos out there on how to do it properly for seniors. They run you through step by step. The other is some kind of aerobic program, because you need the two together, not just the resistance, the aerobic component as well. And that can be done in the summer outdoors. Like I said, a good vigorous walk helps. If you can do, if you're in better shape, you can do maybe say a 10-second little run with a 30-second walk, mm-hmm. and for 12 to 15 minutes. I mean, that's wonderful. You don't have to do long distance running if it's not good for the knees, right? And if you do some running, I always recommend do it on grass. Go find an open field. It's very easy on the knees then. But you don't have to do continuous running for an hour, hour and a half. I mean, that's for somebody just getting into it, that's daunting. Mm-hmm. And it's just not going to be something that most people will undertake. Any type of home program is something that you don't have to get out of the home to go somewhere else, which can be a burden. So if you have 5 feet of space in a home, you can set up a mat if you're able to get down and do some groundwork. And again, they can show you those exercises you can do on YouTube. Or you can do stand-up exercises like presses or arm curls or rows for the back, which are really just getting those muscles moving and getting you independent with strong functional movement again, where you're not losing your balance and you're confident walking again. And you can feel that strength when you're walking, and you can see that confidence when somebody is doing something.
So essentially your message is the risks of inactivity are greater than those of activity. Because there'd be a lot of people who would look at it and say, you know, well, I don't want to hurt myself and that kind of thing. And it is possible to injure yourself doing those things, but you're worse off not doing anything.
Well, exponentially so. I mean, that's the message that's going out today to seniors. Unfortunately, you know, you're getting older, and I hear this all the time. These are recommendations from people coming in saying, look, I was told I have a heart problem, I have this, I have this condition, I'm not supposed to do a lot, and so I'm just sitting around, but I didn't want to do that. Mm. What can I do? Mm-hmm. Now, the risk of that, of you dying early from that inactivity, is decades earlier. And now I always say to people, look, if you do just easy exercises for your condition, you always meet the condition. Mm-hmm. If you have a heart problem, you don't overdo it. Mm-hmm. We don't want to overdo it, but we want to move. And there really isn't a risk. I've trained a lot of seniors, and we just have not run into those risks if you're not overdoing it. And I'd like to talk as well about how much is needed, mm-hmm. for these effects, because really they were saying you should have about three times the recommended average recommendation of exercise. So that really runs into about an hour a day to get these wonderful benefits that they're showing in the studies. If you can't do an hour a day, if that's daunting, if you say, look, I just don't have the energy, do 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. If you can't do 20 minutes, do 10 minutes.
Right. Anything's better than nothing.
Anything is better than nothing. Never, never take the recommendation think that you have to sit and that you're too fragile. Because what happens, sitting makes you fragile.
Mm-hmm.
People aren't just inherently fragile. It's the process of inactivity that leads to the frailty.
Well, good stuff. We've been talking with nutritionist and personal trainer Jörg Mardian about aging. He's working on an article about this for The Trumpet magazine. You can watch for that online at thetrumpet.com. An excellent, fascinating subject and something that really is beneficial to all of us. It's easy to kind of wait until things start breaking down before you start thinking about these things. But everything that you've been saying really does apply to us all, doesn't it?
It really does.
Well, we appreciate your time, Jörg. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
Life is a journey of millions of small steps. It's a lot of tiny choices that lead to either good or ill. But the steps are so small and so many that usually we're careless about the step we're taking. It's no big deal, just one little decision, just one step. But how life-changing a single step can be. Every step points in a direction. One step leads to more steps. It leads away from other steps. It can put you on a different path. One step can determine failure or success. It can mean life or death. Both sin and righteousness start with one step. According to the Bible, Lucifer's attempt to dethrone God started with one step. His sin began when he momentarily harbored an attitude of self-love, and then he allowed vanity to lead to self-righteousness, to a sense of entitlement, to resentment, to bitterness, to hostility, step by step down a dark path. Then he spread his attitude. He persuaded and seduced one angel here, two there. Discussion begat dissension, which bred insubordination, which became defiance, which burst into mutiny, revolt, and warfare. This sequence of steps turned the light bringer into the adversary, and it turned millions of brilliant, fiery angels into demons. As with Lucifer, so with us. Sin always starts in the mind. We conceive it, we mull it, it grows, and it bursts into a sinful act, which leads to death. A terrible bad habit starts with one decision to take the easy route. Debt and bankruptcy trace back to the first ill-advised purchase. A broken friendship begins with a single hurtful comment. A bad marriage stems from one unhealthy secret kept from a spouse. That first small step in the direction of sin is always easy to justify. You want to do something that you know you shouldn't. You think that going just part way won't do any harm. But the reality is, every step down that path leads to more steps into sin. That's why God considers that first step already committing the act spiritually, according to the spirit or intent of the law. When we take that first step, in God's eyes, we're already guilty. He recognizes where that first small step leads. That's why he commands in 1 Corinthians 6 that we flee fornication rather than flirt with it. Take steps in the opposite direction rather than getting close to it. The writer of Psalm 119 wrote that God's word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. God's way of life is a narrow path, and we need that light to guide us and to keep us on the path. If you take a step or two off that path, you're in the dark. And if you don't get back on quickly, that lamp can move on. It's important when we recognize that we've taken a misstep to repent immediately and get back on that lighted path right away. The good things we want in life also come step at a time. Just as small steps can take you off the path, small steps also carry you forward to your goal. The Israelites made it from slavery in Egypt to the Promised Land one step at a time. The potential that God has given to human beings is tremendous. The calling of a Christian is awesome, almost too awesome to comprehend, but we fulfill that calling through small daily steps. Prayer, study, work, time management, taking care of our body, our mind, our family, our relationships, our possessions. However overwhelming any given objective may seem, recognize the power in using right now to take one step toward that objective. Savings in the bank can start with a dollar. A healthy diet can start with one resisted temptation. A close friendship can start with a single compliment. Force yourself to do the first small thing, and you've started moving in the right direction. God tells us to be attentive to our every step in Proverbs 4, verses 25 through 27. It says, "Let your eyes look right on, and let your eyelids look straight before you. Ponder the path of your feet, and let all your ways be established. Turn not to the right hand nor to the left. Remove your foot from evil." So, whatever your next step, recognize the power of that simple, everyday choice you're about to make. Joel Hilliker, we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Brent Noctegal, Chris Eames, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with this thought from M.A. Stoddart. All that you do, do with your might. Things done by halves are never done right. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.